So the way that we'll evaluate these commutators is that A plus and A minus depend on X and P. So we'll just write out this commutator and futz around with it until we've reduced everything down to the XP commutator. And we'll be able to find the eigenenergies and the eigenkets in that way. And then if you really, really want to translate it into position space at the end, I'll show you how to do that. So the nice thing about solving it after you know all the other things is that it turns out, instead of being a second-order differential equation in space, it's a first-order differential equation in space, and that means you can just integrate it. Okay, so that's what I plan to talk about today. Questions? Okay. So this is a reminder of last time. Remember last time we solved the differential equation in position space, and we found that the energy eigenvalues, the E sub n's, were n plus a half h bar omega. And we chose the convention that we start at n equals 0. So the ground state energy is 1 half h bar omega. And then we calculated these functions, the stationary state functions, the energy eigenfunctions. Y is the dimensionless position variable because it's a lot more convenient than leaving x in there. And we have that the stationary states are the Hermite polynomials times a Gaussian. Right, and we obtain this solution by solving the time-independent Schrodinger equation. So I didn't draw this picture last time. This is supposed to be a picture of a parabolic energy well, and it's supposed to show you where the energies are. So the ground state, the n equals 0 state, has an energy of 1 half h bar omega. The first excited state, the n equals 1 state, has an energy of 3 halves h bar omega. The next one has an energy of 5 halves h bar omega. So the energy spacing between the energies in the harmonic oscillator is always h bar omega. If you remember, in the square well, the energy spacing went up. The first one in some units was 1. The next one was 4. The next one was 9. The next one was 16. So we have two cases now, one in which the energies get more and more separated as you go up. One in which the energies have exactly the same separation as you go up. And the next problem we solve, the hydrogen atom will have energy levels that get closer and closer together as we go up. So just so the ground state energy is 1 half h bar omega. And if you had a classical harmonic oscillator, then its ground state would be for the particle to sit in the bottom of the well and not move at all. But the quantum case can't do that. It can't have energy equal to 0. Because if it set at exactly one point, it would be a delta function here. And the curvature of a delta function is infinite. So in order to satisfy its potential energy, in order to lower its potential energy as much as possible, it wants to be in the center of the well. In order to have its kinetic energy be as low as possible, it wants to have minimum curvature. The minimum curvature and the most in the center of the well is a Gaussian for this problem. For the infinite square well, it was a sine wave. So this energy is called the zero point energy. And this energy means that when you cool down a solid to zero temperature, that it still has phonons in it running around. And if you like, you can think of it as consequence of delta x, delta p being greater than or equal to h bar over 2. Okay. And the vacuum has the same thing. The vacuum has a zero-point energy, an infinite zero-point energy, which is why the vacuum was always turning into quasi-particles and then turning back into the vacuum. So people want to harness the energy of the vacuum. It's like the old dream to make a perpetual motion machine. Unfortunately, I think it's doomed to the same fate as making a perpetual motion machine. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to find these two linear operators, namely A dagger, which I'm going to call the raising operator, the creation operator, and A, which I'm going to call the lowering operator or the destruction operator. This dagger means transpose conjugate. Now, this formalism is really important. It turns out that when you go to do field theory, then you're going to have ladder operators for the phonons. When you do the quantum optics, you're going to have ladder operators for the photons. When you do quantum electrodynamics, you're going to have ladder operators for the electrons and for the photons. And Feynman said that he said he didn't want to. At first he didn't want to learn this because he said it was kooky. How could you create an electron when there wasn't there before? But it turns out his diagrams did exactly the same thing. And by introducing these operators, your ability to compute goes way up. So finally he gave in. Okay, so now I want to show you some things. So this is not about the harmonic oscillator. This is about the Dirac delta function. So Wolfram doesn't like applets. So instead, he invented Wolfram demonstrations. They're like applets, but they're written in Mathematica, and you can download the source code if you want to. But you can also get for free a Wolfram demonstration reader. And so that's what's here. So the idea is that you can write the delta function as the limiting case of something that gets narrower and narrower and taller, but keeps its integral equal to 1. So one case is a rectangle function. So if you start out with unit width, and then you make it twice as high and twice as narrow, three times as high and three times as narrow, four times as high and four times as narrow. It'd be more impressive if this was shooting off of the screen. But you can see that what happens is, if you could read the numbers, when you go 9 steps, it's 1/9 wide. When you go 10 steps, it's 1/10 wide. So just keep going. Okay. And this is, Dirac invented this in order to pick a value out of a function in just the same way that a Kronecker delta picks a value out of a sum. So there are lots of different representations of the Dirac delta function. Here's what happens if you use Gaussians. And the reason that Gaussians are nice is because you can do the integral with Gaussians and then you can take the limit. Here's what happens if you use Lorentzians. What's the difference between a Gaussian and a Lorentzian? The way that it decays. Gaussians decay very quickly. Lorentzians decay as slowly as you can and still be physical. Their standard deviation is infinite because they have these really long tails. And here is the sinc function, which also does the same thing.
Is the integral of the sinc function 1?
If you normalize it, right? Okay, so now let's go to the repository of all human knowledge. See what Wiki will tell us. So here's the quantum harmonic oscillator in Wiki, and it's showing us over here. These are eigens. So here is the classical harmonic oscillator. It just goes back and forth. Here's the ground state of the harmonic oscillator. It's showing the real part and the imaginary part. And by now, I hope you can visualize what's really happening is that this little thing is just turning around in the complex plane. And I'll show you a better picture of that later. This is a beautiful color picture of the wave functions of the harmonic oscillator. I don't know why the ground state is blue and the first excited state is pink. And I searched for the meaning of that, but it wasn't. Oh, maybe it's only in German. Maybe only in Germany do the wave functions have that color. Okay. So that's prettier pictures of what I already showed you. This is from the hyperphysics site. And the idea here is to show you the difference between the classical probability distribution and the quantum probability distribution. The classical probability distribution is that the thing moves back and forth. The stopping point is where it turns around. At its stopping point, it spends the most time. It spends the least time in the center when it's moving fastest, and it spends, again, a symmetric amount of most time when it comes to the other side. So that's what this curve is. This curve is the classical probability, 1 over the velocity. This is the ground state. This is the first excited state probability, the second excited state probability, the third excited state probability. And as you go up to higher numbers, you can see that the classical distribution is going through the middle of the quantum distribution. So if you imagine the number of wiggles going to infinity, then you can see that in that limit, the quantum harmonic oscillator will look like the classical harmonic oscillator. And that limit is called the correspondence principle. So it's another way of looking at how quantum mechanics reduces to classical mechanics.
The agreement is called what principle?
The correspondence principle. So now here is Wolfram's demonstration of that. So here is the ground state and the classical. So by the time you have 50 oscillations in here, if you have any finite resolution or not, what you'll end up with is finding the center of these wiggles. Because when you average over just a little bit, you'll find the wiggles. So you'll find the center. So imagine you have 10 to the 23 wiggles in there. 10 to the 23 wiggles is going to be indistinguishable from the classical probability distribution. This is just to show you again the same idea. Here's the classical harmonic oscillator. Spends most time there, least time there, most time there. So if you ask what the probability distribution is as a function of x, then you find that it looks like this. It has the lowest probability density in the middle. It has the highest probability density on the ends. And the other part of this applet doesn't work, so I won't show it to you. And this is the did I get rid of the one I want? Yeah, I did. So there's a French website that has a lot of quantum simulations. The second version of it is better than the first version of it. The second version won't run in Firefox, but it will run in Safari. I have no idea whether it will run in Internet Explorer or not. So this shows you how a two-slit diffraction pattern caused by random photons turns into the two-slit diffraction pattern that you see in all the textbooks. But I want to go over here. So here is their attempt to show you what happens when you have a stationary state. So here is the real part of the wave function. This yellow line is the imaginary part of the wave function. Here is the real axis. And so right now, you can see the wave function is green because it's along the real axis. Its imaginary part is zero. We're looking in cross-section. So if we let the movie run, then what you see is the real part decreases to zero and the imaginary part goes to one if you look at the projections. But what's really happening is that the wave function is multiplied by this complex time-dependent phase factor. And so it just goes around and around. And when you square the wave function, it always looks the same. because it really is just the original pattern being multiplied by e to the I omega t. And if you take the norm of e to the I omega t, you find that it is 1. Now, this also has a mystery in it that I couldn't really figure out, which is that this says the real part is in green and the imaginary part is in pink. So maybe the French have a different notion of pink than I do, or I don't know. Okay. So here's one, as we saw before, where we can, this is another stationary state. So you see exactly the same thing. So that's pretty boring. And here now you can make a superposition of two of the stationary states. So here's the ground state, here's the first excited state, and here is the superposition wave function when you start out at time equals 0. Now if we let this run, you remember what it looks like is that the probability distribution looks like it's sloshing back and forth inside of the potential. Because of the interference between the ground state wave function and the first excited state wave function, the energy isn't changing. The energy is always just the same. So here's the same thing for a square box. The energy right now, this is the ground state energy. This is the first excited state energy, and you can see the energy is halfway between them. If we take this and we change this energy to the ground state energy, then you can see that the probability distribution is stable, doesn't change in time. This is the stationary state. If we take the energy and we move it to the first excited state, then you can see again that the probability distribution is stable, it doesn't depend on time. This is also a stationary state. If we take the probability distribution, take the energy and move it in the middle, then we can see that we get this oscillation. But notice, so if you want to have this energy right here, one way to make that energy right there is to mix together a little bit more of the first excited state with some of the ground state. When you put this exactly in the middle, then the energy is halfway between these two, so you have to have a 50-50 mixture of the ground state and the first excited state. Does that make sense so far?
Can you move it up again really fast?
Move it to the second excited state?
No, just right below that. Just right below
that. Oh, right below that, so you can see how quickly it... It doesn't take very much admixture of the other state to cause quite a lot. This is a model for the ammonia atom. In the ammonia atom, there's a mode which classically has the nitrogen moving through the triangle of the hydrogens. But it turns out the nitrogen's too big to fit in that triangle. So in order to go through, it has to squeeze it down. So there's a well over here, there's a well over here, and there's a barrier between them. So when you're on one side, you're in the low energy state. When you're on the other side, you're in a low energy state. But to go from one to the other, you have to go over some barrier. Now, it doesn't look like the square well situation. They're really smooth barriers, but the idea is exactly the same. So this is the classical picture of what a nitrogen molecule looks like. What does the quantum picture look like? And here's what the quantum picture looks like. The nitrogen is on both sides of the atom at the same time, and its probability to be on one side is bigger than its probability to be on the other side. So it's a superposition state of a state where the whole thing is in this side of the well, and the whole thing is in that side of the well. So here is their applet to show quantum superposition in one dimension with lots of energy states. Why don't we... turn off these. So here's the ground state wave function. Here's its probability distribution. It's stationary. What happens if we mix a little bit of this state in there? We get something going on. What happens if we, but maybe this applet isn't so good for showing this. It's not. Let me show you what I'm trying to show here on with the other applet. Okay. So here's Paul Falstadt's website. I showed you this before when we were looking at the infinite square well. This is, again, the same thing. This is the probability distribution where the colors show you the phase of the wave function. This is in position space. This is in momentum space. So if we go up to one of these higher excited states, then you can see that the momentum distribution has two peaks in it and a bunch of wiggles in it. We talked a little bit about why that's the case. Now let's go to the harmonic oscillator. So here's the harmonic oscillator. This is its ground state, first excited state, second excited state. Notice that the ground state, that the distribution in X space and the distribution in P space look just the same. They're both a Gaussian. They're different spaces, so the dimensions don't matter. If we go to the first excited state, note again that the ground state, that in position space and momentum space, they look just the same. Go to the next state, look the same. Go to the next state, same, 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 same. So this is a very special case where the probability distribution in position space looks exactly like the probability distribution in momentum space. That wasn't the case in the square well, certainly. That isn't the case in any other potential, but that is the case in this potential. And I'll explain the reason for that in more detail, but the reason for that is that the harmonic oscillator is really special because its Hamiltonian is x squared plus p squared. So it's completely symmetric in x and p. So the wave functions in x have to look just like the wave functions in p. That's probably enough for this. Now what happens if, so far we've done everything in one dimension. We want to go now to three dimensions so we can solve the hydrogen atom. What do you think happens if we go to a two-dimensional harmonic oscillator? So now you can imagine a set of springs along X, a set of springs along Y. You can imagine that the restoring force depends on the distance from the origin, that distance R. So if you move it in the XY direction, then nothing happens to the springs in the Y direction. If you move in the X direction, nothing happens to the springs in the Y direction, so it moves just as usual. If you move it in the Y direction, the springs in the X direction don't stretch, so it moves just as usual. What happens if you move it, so it's a superposition of X and Y? Well, then the X part will move just like the X part wants to, and the Y part will move just like the Y part wants to. So this problem breaks down into the product of the X solution and the Y solution. So here's Falstadt's applet for that. So he's made, if you look down here at the clocks, you can see that an awful lot of clock hands are turning around. So he's made quite a complicated superposition state to make this pretty spinning ball. Let's just look at the ground state. So that's the ground state in position space. It's just a Gaussian in X, a Gaussian in Y, and a Gaussian all the way around. It's changing its phase as time goes on, and it corresponds to this little hand on the clock. We can make this bigger. if I want to now raise the energy of the oscillator, I have two choices. I can raise the energy of the X oscillator and leave the energy of the Y oscillator the same, or I can do it vice versa. So here he has it set up so it'll do these symmetric combinations. So this is what happens if you mix together the first excited state in the X direction and the ground state in the Y direction. If we do it just the opposite way around, then it looks like this. It's just rotated by 90 degrees. If I put both of them together, then you can see you get this more interesting looking probability distribution. Now for this problem, it turns out that we can decompose it in X and Y, as I've just shown you, or we can also decompose it in terms of a radial oscillation and an angular oscillation. So let's see.
Mm-hmm. So what we're looking at on the screen here is that the intensity of the color indicates an increase in probability that the position is at that location. And then it gets fainter as it goes away from the center, and that means that it's less likely that the particle will be
fine. Right, so it has two lobes.
So we're kind of looking at the top of the
right. So this is like what we saw in the square well where the two lobes went up and down. This is the same thing. Here are the lobes above the center and below the center are going up and down.
Okay.
And the red line is showing where the expectation value is. And if you want to see where the uncertainties are, then that box shows you where the what the uncertainties are. So you can see the uncertainty in the X direction is fixed. The uncertainty in the Y direction is going up and down. So this is just like the sloshing back and forth in the square well, except now we have a two-dimensional case. Turn this off. And change this from rectangular states to angular states. Okay. And so let's make the rectangular states be little and just look at the angular states. So again, the ground state has no quanta in the X oscillator and no quanta in the Y oscillator. So it looks just like what we saw before. There are two first excited states. Sorry, added them together. I only want this one. Which has a quantum in one of them, you can see, is turning around. So that means that the phase is a function of the angle as you go around. If we go into the other state, you can see that it's just the same, but it turns around in the opposite direction. So this is like the superposition of two oscillators classically, where you can, if you put it along 45 degrees, then it goes around in a circle like that. Okay. So these are angular momentum states now, and we're going to start to talk about angular momentum. So I thought I would show them to you now. I'm also contemplating putting them on the exam. So I sort of wanted to see how shell-shocked you looked before I made that decision. Now I have a question. It's actually more for Paul Falstead than it is for you. This picture has been here for maybe 20 years. So I don't think his son or daughter looks like that anymore. Probably this son or daughter is now in some university somewhere.
I'm looking at that page. I'm possibly looking at that page in their own class.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is another Wolfram demonstration. A long time for such a simple demonstration. So let's start in the n equal 2 state. The energy of the n equal 2 state is 2.5. If I apply the raising operator to it, it goes to the n equal 3 state. If I play the raising operator again, it goes to the n equal 4 state. If I apply the lowering operator, it goes down. So every time I apply the raising operator, it goes up one state. And every time I apply the lowering operator, it goes down one state. I don't know why it took so long to load that. And I might as well show you this since we're here. Now, there's another very cool thing about the harmonic oscillator is that here is its ground, the state, its stationary state, its ground state, the probability distribution. But now we can we can make a superposition, a Gaussian superposition, inside of the harmonic oscillator well, and it moves back and forth like a Gaussian inside the well. So this is not a stationary state of the harmonic oscillator, but it is, so these are called coherent states, and this is the thing that Roy Glauber got the Nobel Prize for 2 years ago, for working out these states in the case of photons. So these are special states where there's a coherence between the different levels. Okay. Back to Wiki. For the harmonic oscillator, sorry, for the Hermite polynomials. Yeah?
In the coherent states graph, that formulated the idea that if you add energy to a particle in a harmonic oscillator, it jumps up, and its probability distribution, the shape of it, changes. And so there you just showed me a case where you added energy to it, but its shape did not change.
Right. So that's another very special.
It's explained to me that the shape changes, but now you just show me that it doesn't.
So another very special thing about the harmonic oscillator is that that state is not a stationary state. It's not any of the stationary states. It's a Gaussian inside that well. And we know that the well holds all the stationary states to have a Gaussian envelope. This shows you that you can actually make states that are Gaussians that propagate undisturbed back and forth inside this well.
I also noticed that it didn't jump from energy level to energy level. So is it, are you saying that those coherent states actually aren't quantized? Or is that just an artifact of the software?
they're not quantized in the same way. Don't worry about them. They won't be on the exam. Where does it say this? Oh, yeah. In mathematics, the Hermite polynomials are a classical orthogonal polynomial sequence that arise in probability, such as the Edgeworth series. In combinatorics, as an example of the Apple sequence obeying the umbral calculus. In numerical analysis, is Gaussian quadrature, and in physics, where they give rise to the eigenstates of the quantum harmonic oscillator. They're also used in systems theory in connection with nonlinear operations on Gaussian noise. They're named after Charles Hermite, although they were studied early by Laplace and Chebyshev. That's not what I'm trying to, yeah, this is what I want to show you. And there are two standard ways of normalizing Hermite polynomials. This way, which is the probabilist polynomials, and this way, which is the physicist, physicist Hermite polynomials. Okay. So we have different conventions for the normalization. So here are the mathematicians' Hermite polynomials, and here are the physicists' Hermite polynomials. And in the old days, if you wanted to know the hydrogen wave functions, then you would go to the table that showed you these Hermite polynomials, and you would then multiply them by the Gaussian, and then you would futz around to get the normalization factor right. But nowadays, if you want to know the harmonic oscillator wave functions, don't go to the Hermite polynomials. Just go to the harmonic oscillator wave functions, because then the normalization will already be done. So this is from Wolfram's. Wolfram has 2,372 formulas for polynomials. Notice that there are 165 formulas for Hermite polynomials, 108 for Laguerre polynomials. We're going to meet the Laguerre polynomials in the hydrogen atom, another 158 for a modified set of Laguerre polynomials, 167 for Legendre polynomials. Then, fortunately, we're not going to use the Chebyshev polynomials or the Guggenbauer polynomials or the Jacobi polynomials. But we are going to use the Legendre polynomials and their magic combination of the spherical harmonics. So there are lots of different classical orthogonal polynomials. They're good basis sets for different problems. In physics, we're interested in things which are good basis sets for a quantum problem. Okay, so that's what I was going to say about the qualitative aspects. Questions about the qualitative aspects? Mm-hmm.
So the orthogonal polynomials, you say that we can always combine certain amounts of all the polynomials to get any function approximate or reach any function we like.
That's right. You can make a decomposition of any function with the associated weight.
So why do we need so many different?
Because we have different potentials, so we need to have a different set of orthogonal polynomials for each potential. If I take the Hermite polynomials and use wave functions built out of them into the hydrogen atom, they won't be eigenstates. So the Hermite polynomials multiplied by Gaussian are the eigenstates of the harmonic oscillator. The Laguerre polynomials multiplied by a decaying exponential weight are the eigenfunctions of the hydrogen atom. So each potential has its own distinct set of orthogonal functions.
That's not the reason they were discovered in the first place.
I know. But that's our interest in them in this class. Yeah. Other questions? So this is from the class webpage. The virtual book has three sections on the harmonic oscillator and then the figures for that. And then it has a summary of the harmonic oscillator that I wrote a while ago, and I'm going to tell you more about it. Then it has the chapter by Griffiths about the simple harmonic oscillator and the chapter by Shankar about the simple harmonic oscillator. So, who is this man, and why is he not smiling? This is a picture of Shankar. This is another picture of Shankar, and you can see the blackboard behind him. What is he teaching? So, this coefficient B is K minus K prime over K plus K prime. This coefficient C is 2K over K plus K prime. Does that remind you of any problem? Like the potential step problem, for example. Yeah, so he's teaching the scattering from a potential step. Here are two quotes by Shankar. The first one is, once we've bitten the quantum apple, our loss of innocence is permanent. And the second one is, in this section, I will put the harmonic oscillator in its place on a pedestal. So he gave an amusing lecture. We don't need to listen to all of it, so let's start here.
Thanks a lot, Leo. Thank you all for coming this evening. I will try to return the favor. If any of you want to give a public lecture, I will show up in the audience and fill the room. I wasn't always that way, but I learned this art of give and take from the great American philosopher Yogi Berra, who said, you should always go to other people's funerals or they won't come to yours. So I also thought, like you, that it was funny. So did I think this title of this talk, when you come to a fork in the road, you should take it. Apparently someone asked Yogi how to come home, and he said, turn left, turn right, you come to this fork, you take this fork. And he went on, and then people stopped there and were making fun of him, and including me. Till one day, when I was thinking, I realized this is not a joke, because this is exactly what particles do in the atomic scale. They come to the fork, they take the fork. I'll tell you how that happens. But I told myself, as a responsible physicist, you should not be laughing at this joke. It's off limits for you. So that's fine. I went on for a while, then one day something was nagging in the back of my head, so I went to the Yogi Berra website of all his collected quotations. Then my worst fears were confirmed, that every quotation that Yogi Berra is known for reflects a deep principle in physics. So I said, you cannot laugh at any of Yogi's jokes, because they're all serious stuff. So ever since then, I've been kind of dumb, because you take that out of my life, there's not much left. So anyway, look, I don't want to talk about me. Let's focus on you guys, the lay members in the audience. I detect a certain tension in this room, because you're saying, this guy's going to talk about quantum mechanics, I'm going to feel stupid, I won't understand it, I got enough problems, you know, inflation, gas prices, this, that. Who needs one more thing to feel bad about? So I want to put you at ease, if you're not used to the subject, by quoting one of our legendary physicists, Richard Feynman, who simply said, no one understands quantum mechanics. That means Feynman doesn't, I don't, you don't, he doesn't, no one gets it, okay? So I really don't think I'm going to change that with 1 hour of lecturing. So stop worrying about it. Nothing's going to change. Just relax, okay? You have no obligation whatsoever to follow what I'm saying, okay? So one reasonable question people have is, if we don't know quantum mechanics and you don't know quantum mechanics, what's the difference? Well, the difference is you don't know quantum mechanics and you keep quiet, whereas I'm up here with a microphone. That's the problem. Look, actually, there are some differences. I mean, it's an extreme thing to say, I don't know quantum mechanics. What I mean is, at a gut level, no one gets it, but I know how to do all the calculations, you know, how to take quarks and gluons and put them together to form protons, and put protons together, neutrons, and form the nucleus, then atoms and molecules. So I know all that stuff, but I'm not allowed to talk about that, because to do that, you have to use a lot of mathematics, and Leo has told me I'm not allowed more than 2 equations, 2 or 3, this evening. So my hands are tied. I'm frustrated. I feel like Bill Clinton at a convention for celibates. Because everything that I'm good at, I'm not supposed to bring to the table, so I don't know what to do. So maybe I should give you a better analogy for the younger people in the audience. It's like trying to explain Romeo and Juliet to some person who has no notion of love or romance. So I want you to imagine somebody who has no concept of romance, love. So for definiteness, let's say a physicist, okay? So you're going along, and the physics person comes doing this, and you say, hey, physics person, what are you doing with your hands? You into rap music? I said, no, it's not rap music. I want to know that if the electron goes this way and the magnetic field is in this direction. So anyway, we're the guys who introduce this thing to rock music. This is right-hand rule, left-hand. Anyway, you ask this physics person, you sure you don't watch MTV? No, I don't even have a TV. Actually, my parents gave me a TV, but I rewired it and took it to the lab and turned it into an oscilloscope. So that's the kind of person you're dealing with, and you have to tell the person what's great about Romeo and Juliet. So you start by saying, you know, Romeo and Juliet are in love. You're immediately stopped. Don't use the word love. I'm not familiar with the expression. Explain it in some other way. Say, well, Romeo and Juliet feel an attraction. Oh, I get it. So it's the attraction proportional to the product of the two masses. He says, no, it's not the mass, but how it is shaped that seems to be more important. So you realize there is a communication problem. So that's the problem I experienced talking about quantum mechanics to non-specialists. But I decided I will try anyway, because after all, physics is a subject that deals with the physical world, and even though it's mathematical, It's got to be saying something that we can tell everybody else about. And it turns out there are a few things.
So you can listen to the rest of it if you like. It's on the. It's in here. Just give you a quick version of it. I think everybody knows what he's going to talk about. There's also a clip of David Griffiths. So if you want to see what great David Griffiths looks like, you can go to this clip. And there's every time somebody says, Feynman says, nobody understands quantum mechanics, then I try to remind them that that's what he said in 1963, but in 1982 he told a different story. He said, we've always had a great deal of difficulty understanding the worldview that quantum mechanics represents. At least I do, because I'm an old enough man that I haven't got to the point this stuff is obvious to me. Okay, I still get nervous about it. You know how it is, that every new idea, it takes a generation or two until it's obvious that there's no real problem. I cannot define the real problem, therefore I suspect there's no real problem, but I'm not sure there's no real problem. There is no problem. This is a picture of David Griffiths. There's another picture of David Griffiths teaching the decay of the muon. And here's a picture from David Griffiths' book about a cat climbing up the ladder of states for the harmonic oscillator. So this is what I'm going to talk about in the second hour. And I don't know if you know the cover of David Griffiths' quantum mechanics book, but it has a live cat on the front and has a dead cat on the back. So just if you happen to look at his quantum mechanics book, you can see that David Griffiths has something for cats. Then I found this cartoon, which I thought was funny. The physicist has come and says, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been forever since my last confession, and I've been having impure thoughts. Sob. What kind of impure thoughts? Classical. I've been a quantum physicist for years now, and I still find myself lapsing back into the dark abyss of classical thinking. I'm so ashamed. Classical thinking is so seductive, and I can't resist its common sensual temptations anymore. Sob. Sigh. Okay, just do some free particle propagator derivations and 10 Hail Marys. I absolve you. Thank you, Father. Okay, so let's take our break now. And that 5 minutes after, I'll start to talk about ladder operators. Who is that man on the back of your book? Oh, is that George?
I didn't know he was a pseudonym. His actual name is Eric Blair.
There you go.
You know, it's interesting because oftentimes in polite society, when people are discussing things, they trot out Orwell. To learn that I don't think that 99% of the people that quote or evoke Orwell have read Orwell. That is kind of a testament to the penetration that his ideas have had, that they become used as cliches.
So sort of like Darwin and Einstein and Feynman and bunch of other people.
Is there a cat in the box? All kinds of different things. I misused it in the same way because that's how I heard it before I learned it.
But plagiarism is basic to all culture. I had a question for you. The lab report you sent me was not your last one, or was it your last one?
Not my last
one. Okay, I just, yeah.
Yeah.
When you send the last one, say, this is the last one.
I will.
Just so I, yeah, thanks. Okay. So now I'm going to talk about how to solve the harmonic oscillator problem using ladder operators. In the next unit, when we solve angular momentum, I'm going to show you how to solve angular momentum with ladder operators. And in the next unit, when we solve the hydrogen atom, I'm going to show you how to solve the hydrogen atom with ladder operators. I will also show you how to solve angular momentum as a differential equation, ugly as it is, and I will show you how to solve the hydrogen atom with a differential equation, even uglier as it is. Okay. So I wrote this. I would say the ladder operator solution of the harmonic oscillator is not very difficult, but it's subtle. And so I made a, I tried to make something that explains the step-by-step part without all of the details. And so that's what's here. And so maybe I'll come back and talk about this after. Okay. Excuse me. So here's the time-independent Schrodinger equation for anything. The Hamiltonian acting on its eigenkets is equal to the associated eigenvalue times that eigenket. Now let's write the expression in the Hilbert space using Dirac notation for what the time-dependent Schrodinger equation looks like for the harmonic oscillator. So for the harmonic oscillator, there are two terms. There's the kinetic energy term, p squared over 2m, that we also spoke about when we did the free particle. And then there is the potential energy term, the energy associated classically with compressing the spring, and that energy is 1 half m omega squared x operator squared. Okay? So here's p operator and here's x operator. This is still in the Hilbert space. So this combination of operators acting on the En eigenket has to be equal to the En eigenvalue times the En eigenket. So now we're going to solve this using, without ever going into a basis, using only the relationships that we can find about these operators. Okay. So basically what we're going to do is we're going to use the canonical commutation relation, the fundamental commutation relation, the relationship between X and P, the origin of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle that says X operator, the commutator between X operator and P operator is IH cross times the identity operator. But even though the commutator is an operator, and so if you want to be technically correct, you should put the identity operator here. But that's too much trouble, and we almost never do it. So if you see an operator equal to this, some number, then you know that it's really that number times the identity operator. Okay. This commutator is basis independent. It works in any basis just the same. Let's look at it in the position basis. So in the position basis, we want to calculate x operator p operator minus p operator x operator. That's this commutator. We know in the x basis that x operator corresponds to multiplication by x. We know that in the x basis, p operator corresponds to multiplication by minus a minus I h cross d by dx. And so when we write this out in terms of multiplication by x and derivatives with respect to x, we get this. And notice that it doesn't cancel because it matters whether or not you multiply by x before you take the derivative or after you take the derivative. That is, when this term acts on x times some function, you have to use the chain rule. Okay? So this term cancels, and this term cancels, but you're left with d by dx, which is 1. So if you just put in the form of x operator and p operator in position space and calculate what you get, you find that you get IH cross. In exactly the same way, if you do it in terms of the momentum operators, then again you have x op p op minus p op x op. But now x op is IH cross d by dp, and now p operator is multiplication by p. So the same thing happens, the chain rule thing happens, and you end up with the operator x op p op minus p op x op being equal to IH cross. You notice any other basis you like, commutators are independent of the basis. Why? Well, because they tell us something about the relationship between the operators. The relationship between the operators aren't a basis thing. They're a thing in the Hilbert space. Okay. So that's the first idea. The second idea is to factor the Hamiltonian operator. And in old days, well, when Schrodinger first did this, and for a while afterwards, this was called the factorization method. These days, it's called the operator, the ladder operator method. But here's the idea. If you take away some constants, then the Hamiltonian is p squared plus x squared. It's completely symmetric in p and x. We want to factor that. Can we factor it? Well, if we multiply x plus ip times x minus ip, then if these are numbers, that factors it. But these aren't numbers. That is, it matters whether you multiply p times x or whether you multiply x times p. So let's work out the consequences of that. So we introduce the two ladder operators, the lowering operator, in which we make a dimensionless x operator. So this coefficient takes care of the dimensions of the x operator. And I times this thing takes care of the dimensions of the p operator times p operator. And a dagger is just the complex conjugate of that. So all we have to do is change that plus I into that minus I. Because x operator and p operator are Hermitian. So when we take their, we take the dagger of this, x operator is the same as x operator. X operator dagger is the same as x operator, and p operator dagger is the same as p operator. So now we have something that almost factors the Hamiltonian. There's going to be a leftover piece, and what we need to do is calculate what the leftover piece is. So x op and p op are Hermitian, but A and A dagger are not. This is Hermitian. This is Hermitian. But when you take the dagger of this, this I causes the sum not to be Hermitian. And similarly here. A and A dagger not being Hermitian means that they're not physical operators. There is no physical observable that corresponds to A and A dagger. Okay, so so now I want to write down the Hamiltonian in terms of A and A dagger. So let's start out by calculating what A dagger A is equal to. So A dagger A is that coefficient, this this M omega coefficient times X operator minus I times another coefficient. So that's A dagger. Here is A, and I'm using C and D rather than the coefficients because we'll put the coefficients in at the end, but it's really ugly if you leave them in from here. So you multiply this out, and you get C squared X operator squared minus I squared D squared P operator, and then you get this cross term that if these were numbers would go away, but because they're operators, it doesn't go away. Okay? So now if we put in the value of C squared, the value of C squared is M omega over 2H bar, and if we put in the value of d squared is 1 over 2m omega h bar. And if we put in c times d, then c times d is m omega over 2h bar times 1 over 2m omega h bar. And we know that the commutator between x and p is I h cross. So what we find is that the is that a times a dagger is equal to the Hamiltonian operator divided by h bar omega minus a half. So now we have the we can solve this now for the Hamiltonian in terms of the ladder operators. Okay. So now we want to use this to find the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. So here I've written it out in terms of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is a dagger a plus a half times h bar omega. So let's make a dimensionless Hamiltonian. The energy scale in the problem is h bar omega. So let's make an h which has the energy h bar omega taken out of it. That is to say, we've changed from the variable e into the variable epsilon, which is e over h bar omega. And I always start out by putting a hat over h to indicate that it's the dimensionless one, but I always get really tired writing h hat, and so I stop writing h hat. So here is the time-independent Schrodinger equation. H hat, the dimensionless Hamiltonian, acting on one of its energy eigenkets, epsilon sub n, is equal to epsilon n sub n times the corresponding energy eigenket. So now we're going to solve this using only the algebra of the commutators, and we need three commutators. The first, here they are. We need to know what the commutator between A and A dagger is. We need to know the commutator between A and the dimensionless Hamiltonian, and we need to know the commutator between A dagger and the dimensionless Hamiltonian. So you can see somebody forgot to put a hat here. Now, we don't know any of those commutators. The only commutator we know is this one, x op p op. So what we're going to do is just write these out. After all, A just depends on X up and P up, and H just depends on X up and P up, and A dagger just depends on X up and P up. So we'll just write them all down and do some algebra until we've reduced all of the commutators to this. Then we'll put in IH cross for this, and then hopefully we'll be in a good place. So let's calculate the first commutator on that list, AA dagger. So if we just write that out, it's AA dagger minus A dagger A. So now if I write down A and A dagger in this notation that suppresses all of those square roots, then it's just the expression for A, the expression for A dagger, the expression for A dagger, the expression for A. You multiply it all out, and from the first term, you get CX squared plus DP squared minus ICD XP minus PX. So that's good. We know how to evaluate that. And from the second term, you get... since it's a minus sign here, you get CX squared plus DP squared plus ICD times the commutator of X and P. Okay, so the C squared term cancels, the D squared term cancels, and these both have a minus sign. So what you find is that the commutator between A and A dagger is minus 2 times I times C times D times the commutator of X and P. So now if we put the dimensions back in, what we have is minus 2i, and then we have m omega over 2h cross from the position square root when we square it, and 1 over 2m omega h cross from the momentum coefficient when we square it times ih cross. And notice that what we find is that the commutator aa dagger is just equal to 1. It's just equal to the identity operator. So that one worked out. The only number better than 1 is 0. So let's work out the second commutator now. So for the second commutator, our second commutator was the one between A and the dimensionless Hamiltonian. So we just write down what it is. We know the dimensionless Hamiltonian is A dagger A plus a half. So... one half doesn't do anything. That is, A times one half is the same as one half times A. So all we're left with is these first two terms. So we have to calculate the commutator of A dagger A. So we just write everything out. And then we can just regroup the terms. And if we regroup the terms, what we find is that it's the same as the commutator of A dagger times A. So now we have that the commutator between A and the Hamiltonian is just equal to A. So it's just, it's algebra. It's, it looks mysterious, but it's not mysterious. We have one more left, namely the commutator between A dagger and the Hamiltonian. As before, the one half term drops out. So what we have to calculate is A dagger with A dagger A. You write out this times that minus this times that. And notice that, again, you can regroup the terms. And when you regroup the terms, you find that this commutator is A dagger times the commutator between A dagger and A. But we just worked that out, or rather we worked out A dagger. So this one is minus that. So this is minus 1. So now we have the third commutation relation that says that the commutator between A dagger and the Hamiltonian is minus A dagger. Is it okay? Just algebra. But notice how beautifully it works out. These commutation relations have nice, simple answers. And we don't introduce anything out of the... We start with A dagger A and H, and all the commutators stay with those same three operators. It isn't like we have to invent a new operator in order to find this... They have this relationship amongst themselves. Okay, so now we found these commutators, and now the question is, what are they good for? And what they're good for is that they generate adjacent eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So the next thing that I want to show is that when you apply a dagger, you go up the ladder. So that's the raising operator, or the creation operator. When you apply A, you go down the ladder. So that's the lowering operator. So now, to see this, consider an eigenvector of the Hamiltonian. So that means that H, acting on that eigenvector epsilon, is equal to epsilon times the epsilon ket. Now, I haven't put any subscript on epsilon. It is a discrete set of states, so I could put some dummy index here, but I haven't put any dummy index there. Okay, you can put one if you want, I guess. So let's calculate what A does when it operates on an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, and let's calculate what A dagger does when it acts on an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. Now, the handout that I made says that the essential ingredient is this ingredient right here, and it's just too cute to dwell on, but notice that it says that A is AH minus HA. Okay, so this is the AHA theorem. So we know what H does to its eigenkets, and we know how H is related to the operator A, so let's figure out what A does to the eigenkets of H. Okay. So we know when the what we want to know is what is the Hamiltonian acting on A acting on epsilon. Okay. And if we just write it out, then we see that formally it is A dagger A plus a half acting on A epsilon. We want to know what this thing is. We want to know what A does to an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. So we want to know this piece, this H A piece, is what we want to know. So if we write out this commutator, then what we find is that HA acting on epsilon is equal to AH minus A acting on epsilon, just using this. So we know what the Hamiltonian does to one of its eigenkets. It just pulls out an epsilon. So by letting the Hamiltonian act here, we find that the Hamiltonian, when it acts on one of the when it acts on A acting on one of its eigenkets, is just equal to A times the energy minus A times the eigenket. Or if you rewrite this, it's equal to the energy minus 1 times A times the eigenket of E. That means that A is an eigenket of the A epsilon is an eigenket of the Hamiltonian with eigenvalue epsilon minus 1. And that tells us that every time we apply A, we get a new eigenvector whose value is epsilon minus 1. But remember that this is in the dimensionless units, so when we go back to the dimension units, then this thing turns out to be the energy minus h bar omega. There's another issue, which is we should normalize A, and when we normalize A, what we find is that A, when it acts on one of the eigenkets of the Hamiltonian, the nth one, so this would be a number like 0 representing the round state and 1 representing the first excited state, that the action that it has is it takes us down the ladder one step, and the normalization factor is the square root of n. So this is the normalized lowering operator. If we do exactly the same thing for A dagger, then exactly the same aha argument applies, and what we find out is that A dagger, acting one of the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, is a normalization constant times the eigenket 1 up the ladder. Okay. And when you normalize it, it turns into this. A dagger acting on an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian gives us back this factor, n plus 1, times the eigenvector of the Hamiltonian, which is one step up. So this is the normalized raising operator. Okay. So so the ground state energy is 1 half h bar omega. We found that already. Now we found that the raising operator adds 1 unit of h bar omega to this. So it generates 3 halves h bar omega, 5 halves h bar omega, 7 halves h bar omega. And you can go up here as high as you want. So the ground state energy, we already talked about this, is 1 half h bar omega. And it's a compromise between what the potential wants, which is to put all of the electron density in the center of the well, and what the kinetic energy wants, I'm being anthropomorphic, obviously, which is to have the minimum curvature. And that compromise is a Gaussian. Okay, so The only thing left to do is to find the ground state. What we know is we have a sequence of states that are separated by 1, separated by h bar omega. So what happens when we take the A operator and we act on the ground state? Well, we have the A operator acting on epsilon 0, so that means that A is the square root of n, so we get the 0 vector. When we raise on the 0 vector, we also get the 0 vector. And when we take A dagger A on the ground state, we get 0. And A dagger A is just h minus 1/2. So if we put the half on the other side, then what we have is the Hamiltonian acting on its ground state is 1/2 times the ground state ket. Okay. So the first part we showed that the steps are 1 unit of h bar apart. This part we show that that the ground state energy is 1/2 for the dimensionless Hamiltonian, so it's 1/2 h bar omega for the dimensioned Hamiltonian. Now, once we know the ground state, we can create all of the higher states by applying A dagger. So if we apply A dagger once, we create, and put in the normalization constant, we create epsilon 0 plus 1, the first excited state. We apply it twice, we compute the second excited state. We apply it n times, and we compute the nth excited state. Now, we want an orthonormal set of basis vectors. With the Hermite polynomials and the Gaussian weighting, then we just had to put in some normalization factors. In order to have a normalized set here, all we have to do is put in the normalization coefficients, and the normalization coefficients were the square root of n and the square root of n minus 1. So this just goes through that. So here's the summary. The lowering operator, when you act on the state n, gives you the square root of n times n minus 1. That's why when you act on the ground state, it gives you back the 0 vector. And the raising operator, when you act on the nth state, gives you back the square root of n plus 1 times the state 1 up the ladder. Okay, so that is the conclusion of the ladder operator story. Little fast, but if I said it slower, it wouldn't make any more sense. If you want to understand it, you should read that 2-page summary that I made 50 years ago. Because I actually still understood it. Questions? No questions. Okay. So the next thing that I want to do is I want to translate this business into matrix language. So how can we represent the A operator and the A dagger operator and the Hamiltonian operator in terms of matrices? Okay. So the lowering operator, A, when it acts on an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian n, gives us back the square root of n times n minus 1. So that means that if we write A down as a matrix, and the vector that it acts on has the n equals 0 component here, the n equal 1 component here, the n equal 2 component here, then the A matrix is empty except for this one diagonal above the main diagonal, and it has the square root of the integers going down it. So when this acts, it will take you from, if you put a 1 here and this acts, it will take you from here to here. Is it okay? Now, sorry. If I write down the matrix elements of this, which means I write down one quantum number on this side, another quantum number on that side, and the operator in the middle, then this is a compact way to write down this whole matrix, and it says that this matrix element is equal to 0 because of this delta n prime n minus 1, unless n minus 1 is equal to n prime, and in that case it's equal to the square root of n. Okay, so this is just a nice compact way to write down what's there. And if you do a lot of these, you don't want to have a lot of those floating around. This delta function is called the Kronecker delta function. It's the one that Kronecker invented, and it's the one, and it's the thing that pulls out one term in a sum in the same way that the Dirac delta function pulls out one point in a function, one point in an integral. Okay, now if we write down the raising operator rather than the lowering operator, then we just take the complex conjugate of the A operator, and that just flips everything around the diagonal because these are all real anyway, and so the raising operator looks like this. If we want to write down its matrix elements, then we have the same thing. It's 0 unless n prime is equal to n plus 1, and it has this normalization factor now, the square root of n plus 1. We good? Okay, so let's take the zero vector here. Okay, so the zero vector has a 1 here. The ground state has a 1 here and zeros every place else. So when this matrix acts on it, the first column is all zeros, and it gives us back a 0 in this position. The next column has a 1 in the first position and then all zeros, so it gives us back the square root of 1 times 1. So it has raised us from the 0 level to the 1 level.
And position of the non-zero element has changed.
Yes.
I guess I'm not able to see through this the analogous picture in the function world. It would still remain the same function, or it would be a different...
It'll be a new function.
How does that come about? Is kind of...
I'll show you. But the way that it comes about is because remember that A and A dagger were a combination of x and derivatives of x. So if you apply x and the derivative of x to some function, it will make a new function.
Okay.
But let me just say this again, try to say this again. The vector over here this thing acts on, if there's a 1 in the first position, it's the ground state. If there's a 1 in the second position, it's the first excited state. 1 in the third position, it's the second excited state. So this, it's a raising operator, so let's start out in the ground state. So there's a 1 right here. Notice that when we multiply the first row times the vector, we get 0, because all of these are 0. Notice that when we multiply the second row times this vector, we get the square root of 1, because this square root of 1 is multiplied by that 1. Notice when we multiply this row by 1, 0, 0, 0, we get 0 again because the 2 is in the wrong place, the 3 is in the wrong place. So what this matrix does when it acts on the vector 1, 0, 0, 0, 0 is it turns it into 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. Okay. Now we want to make the position operator. And we know the position operator is related to A and A dagger. And in fact, what we know is that the position operator is h bar over 2m omega times a dagger times a plus a dagger. Okay. So add together a and a dagger. That gives you zeros on the diagonal, the square roots of the integers on the diagonal above, and the square root of the integers on the diagonal below, and then this dimensional conversion coefficient. So notice that we've gotten the x operator without ever having to go into position space. And we can calculate exactly what it does using, this shows us exactly what it does if we feed in an energy eigenket or superposition state. The momentum operator is just the same, except that it has an I in it, and it has the... here's the dimensional conversion factor, okay, and it has minus a in it. So it has the dimensionless conversion factor in the I. Then it has the minus the square root of the integers one diagonal above the main diagonal, and the square root of the integers plus the square root of the integers one diagonal below the main diagonal. Then let's write down the Hamiltonian operator. Well, the Hamiltonian operator, if you multiply the Hamiltonian operator, if you take a dagger and add a half to it, turns out to be this. it has the eigenenergies down the diagonal. So the first eigenenergy is 1/2 h bar omega. The next one is 1 unit of h bar omega up. It's 3/2 h bar omega. And so the Hamiltonian operator is diagonal. So we're in the basis of the Hamiltonian, these eigenkets that we're writing down. The basis that we're in is that of the Hamiltonian, and you sort of know that because the ground state is 1 with an infinite number of zeros, and the first excited state is 0 and 1 and then an infinite number of zeros. So the vectors that represent the states are this infinitely long vector that starts at the ground state, first excited state, second excited state, third excited state. So if somebody asked you to calculate something for the 99th excited state, you probably wouldn't be very happy because you'd have to write this down 99 terms of this. So there's probably a better way. And, of course, there is. Professors never say there's a better way unless there's a better way, or unless they want to test their students by giving them an unsolved problem. I'm not going to test you by giving you an unsolved problem. So here's the summary now, that the lowering operator acting on one of the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian gives us back the coefficient, the square root of n, and it gives us back the ket one step lower, so the ket n minus 1. The raising operator, when it acts on one of the eigenkets of the Hamiltonian, moves us up the ladder by one step, and here's the normalization coefficient. The Hamiltonian is a dagger a plus 1/2 times h bar omega. And if you want to generate any state, what you can do is start with the ground state and apply a dagger to it n times, and then you need to divide out all of these terms, and to divide out all of those terms, you have to divide by the square root of n factorial. Okay. So this thing, which is an operator, is, if you like, a generating function because it has derivatives and multiplications in it. But if you apply it to this vector, it'll give you any other vector. There's one other operator floating around, which is called the number operator, and it's a dagger a. So it's the one with the integers down the diagonal, and the a dagger a plus 1/2 is the one that has the 1/2, 3/2, 5/2. I'm going to show you how to do it in the differential equation sense. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you how to calculate the ground state wave function, now that we have this formalism, and then how to calculate any other state. Remember, the equivalent would be in the differential equation world is you have to calculate the Hermite polynomials. You can calculate Hermite polynomials. There are a bunch of different generating formulas for them, but they're all more complicated than this. So I don't know why no book has this in it, but okay. So here we go. We want to find the ground state wave function in position space. Okay. So what we know is that if we apply the lowering operator to the ground state wave function, we get 0. Here is the lowering operator in the Hilbert space. If we translate the lowering operator into position space, then it is multiplication by x with some coefficients and acting on it with minus ih cross d by dx, again with some ugly coefficients. So first thing we do is get rid of the ugly coefficients so we can at least postpone dealing with them for a while. So we define the variable y to get rid of the dimensions of x, and that tells us what dy is, which is the other part we need. And so what happens in this dimensionless version is that the lowering operator turns into this nice-looking thing, 1 over root 2 times y plus d by dy. Okay. So if you apply a to the ground state operator, you get 0. And that means if you do this in position space, you get the same thing. So this is dimensionless position space. But if you apply 1 over root 2 y plus d by dy times the ground state wave function, you get 0. Okay? Notice this is a first order differential equation. It only has one derivative with respect to position. And you can always solve a first-order differential equation by integrating. If you're lucky, you can do the integral. If you're not lucky, then just numerically do the integral. So you get d of psi 0 of y divided by psi 0 of y is equal to minus y dy. So a famous differential equation. So that means that psi 0 of y is some integration constant e to the c times e to the minus y squared over 2. And we choose this integration constant so that this is normalized, so that the integral of this function is 1. Okay. So here is the ground state wave function. We put back in the ugly dimensional coefficients. We put back the ugly dimensional coefficients in here, and this is the ground state wave function in position space. This is exactly the same thing that we got when we pretended to solve the differential equation. To calculate higher states, all we have to do is apply the raising operator to this. So here's the raising operator in dimensionless position units. All you have to do is apply y minus d by dy. To that, you apply it n times, and you'll get the nth excited state of the harmonic oscillator. So it's good to do this. Well, and it will come out like this. So which is better, the differential equation or the algebra, and why?
I think after you know both, probably the algebraic is better. But if you don't know both, at least you want to be able to see what's happening in the differential.
So you're saying it's like opera. Nobody likes opera when they first go, but after you go there a lot, then you'll be very fond. Nobody likes ladder operators the first day they see them, but I haven't shown you the best thing about ladder operators yet. The best thing about ladder operators is, suppose you want to calculate, take two, make a superposition state of two stationary states and calculate what x does. If you want to do that with the functions, they have to write down one function, x, the other function, and do the integral. If you want to do that with ladder operators, I'll show you that's actually a very easy thing to do. So for calculating lots of things, ladder operators are much better. And they're more insightful. So here is another Wolfram demonstration. This one shows you the fundamental commutation relations in quantum mechanics. This one's really not complicated, so. So if you want to know the commutation relation between x and px, it's IH cross. If you want to know the commutation relation between x and py, it's 0. If you want to know the commutation relation between x and pz, it's also 0. So when we go to three dimensions, we're going to need to know what the commutation relations are for x and y and z. And that's all that shows you. This one, however, I like. This is Schrodinger's cat on catnip. So here is Schrodinger's cat inside the box. And here's catnip. I think he's going to end up dead, so I don't know why catnip would kill him. But here's time. So let's get the time thing down here. So if we let time evolve, the Copenhagen interpretation says don't say anything till the end. It goes back to the beginning. You are not allowed. You know the state of the cat at zero time, but you don't know the state of the cat I guess you turn on the catnip at 0.1 seconds. The state of the cat is not defined. Not defined, not defined, not defined, not defined. State of the cat is not defined 100 time steps later. 101 time steps, 102 time steps, 103, up, we find that the cat is still alive. Okay? The cat is not defined in between. Now, what does quantum superposition say? Quantum superposition says that the cat goes into the superposition state between dead and alive. And the first time, the first cat ends up dead. The second cat ends up alive. The third cat ends up dead. And it's a random, it's random how the nth cat ends up. So this is pretty expensive on cats. You need to have a big budget for cats. This is the same thing for the collapse of the wave function for the double slit experiment. So this is now 2D. The packet you see are the probability distribution. You can see the probability distribution when it goes to the edge. You can see that this time it had a click here, so it collapsed to that point. They've made their slits out of mirrors, so you get both the forward transmitted beam and the backward beam. This time, when it measured over here. So it measure, so when it measures, everything collapses, and you get you find everything at one point in the detector. And there's this nice quote by Galileo, measure what's measurable and make measurable what is not so. Well, I had one other fun one, but you know all the walks into a bar jokes. So Schrodinger's cat walks into a bar, or not. See you, it's Wednesday, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, see you next week.
Sunday.
Sunday. Or Sunday if you come on Sunday.
Is that 10 again?
Oh, is Monday a holiday? Monday might be a holiday. You're supposed to tell me. I have no idea. I fortunately, every holiday so far, some student asked me, so I was able not to show up here on the holiday.
I probably would have showed up. Sunday is at 10 again?
11 to 1.
11 to 1.
Is it going to be here?
Going to be here in this classroom.